Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey everyone, it's Caroline from G-Thanks Just Bought It, reminding you that in between episodes, you can find me on Instagram at G-Thanks Just Bought It Pod. You can find products that don't make it onto the episodes and recommendations from listeners like you. So before you start this episode, give it a follow and say hi in the comments. And for a full list of every product we featured on G-Thanks, visit gthanksjustboughtit.com/episodes. See you there. Hey everyone, welcome to another week of G-Thanks Just Bought It, the podcast where we talk about what we just bought and what you might need to buy next. My guest today is Cora Harrington. She started The Lingerie Addict. You might know that website. Her book, In Intimate Detail, How to Choose, Wear, and Love Lingerie. Everyone loves it. We have not talked about lingerie at all on this podcast. And now the podcast has been out for almost a year and I feel like it's time. So Cora, I'm very happy to welcome you.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy that you invited me.
Yay. I'm glad to have you. I think we've gotten some requests in the past, like when can we start talking about this and this and this? And I feel like as listeners, we're now, you know, we're part of a community now. We know each other. We can get a little bit deeper, a little bit more intimate about our product recommendations. It's time to start talking about lingerie. How long have you been doing The Lingerie Addict?
I've been running it since April 2008, so almost 13 years now.
Wow. And when you started it, what were you like, what did you think it was going to be?
I didn't really have a long-term goal or plan. This is my second career. Before this, I worked in the nonprofit industry. And so my blog was very much a hobby, just something I was doing on the side that was fun and it wasn't serious and it had nothing to do with my day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any larger plans for it. It wasn't until I decided to start running my site full time that I began thinking about a future for it and how I might want to grow it or what else I might want to get from it.
Wow. And when did you go from, you know, like hobby blog to a full-time job?
I think 8 years ago.
Wow. That's a really long time.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny. There are so many kind of, I feel like, stories and recommendations and kind of guides on how to be a full-time blogger. Yeah. But a lot of it is, let me see, how can I put this? A lot of it just isn't glamorous. Like there are people who are making a full-time living from what they do, just kind of like chilling and focusing on a niche and just kind of doing their thing day to day. And I feel like this is a little bit off topic. But I feel like one of the funniest things is that people think what you do is so glamorous. And I do love my job. I talk about lingerie every day. But like quite a bit of it is also just kind of grinding away and doing things like bookkeeping.
Yes.
Deeply not fun.
Yes. A lot of there's a lot of spreadsheets involved. No, I get it. And like I have been a freelance writer myself for like 3 years. And before that I was working a full-time job and also freelance writing. And yeah, like everyone's like, oh, that must be so nice. And I'm like, it's a lot of paper. Like it's a lot of like emails. Yeah, there's a lot of non-fun stuff. There's mm-hmm. I feel like as long as I'm having fun, like 51% of the time, I'm good.
Right.
Just tip me over the edge. But yeah, I get what you mean. Like, I get what you mean. And also the, you know, the onslaught of like Instagram and just seeing everybody's like social platforms also sort of holds this fake narrative that like all everyone does all day is like looks cute and takes pictures. But sometimes it can be just a slog.
Well, I feel like I'm so old because I was like blogging in the days of Blogger and Google Reader and before Facebook had brand pages. And so I feel like I've really been able to see the development of this area and of this space. And one of the things that is really exciting is that there are so many more tools and platforms available for people to explore niches and for people to share things with their readers. But it's definitely been interesting seeing blogs go from being a very trendy thing about a decade or so ago to falling out of favor with social media. Everybody had to have a Facebook page or a Twitter account, then a Pinterest account, then an Instagram account. And now we're seeing things kind of swoop back around to where blogs are beginning to become popular again and newsletters are beginning to become popular again.
That's right.
So that's very funny to me as someone who started out in that space and kind of stuck with it when it wasn't cool anymore.
Yeah.
Seeing it kind of circle back because people want to control their own platforms again.
That's right.
People want to be able to post thoughts that are longer than 180 characters. Yeah. People don't want to have to rely on algorithms.
You don't want to use another platform like for monetization. It's a lot easier to take control of that on your own blog. But I was going to say you kind of started from the ground level. You know, 2008 was like the true heyday. Like everyone had a blog. Like everyone had a blog. And then by 2012, you kind of like, you know, the 10% of those people rose up and actually were able to do it, you know, long term or expand. And it sounds like obviously you were part of that. But what is and like I feel like with Instagram swipe up, like you can finally bring people back to the blog again. When before it was just like, you know, wrote about this today on the blog, and then you'd have to like write an Instagram post that was like a diluted version of the same thing that you had already written on the blog, and like there's no way to link an Instagram. I mean, yeah, it is really difficult because now you're playing by these, you know, essentially Facebook's rules. But you're right.
Facebook does not like lingerie. I just want to say that Facebook what does you, not like lingerie.
Do they filter you out? Does their algorithm filter you out?
There's a lot of shadow banning, It's frustrating because there's this idea that you can't talk about. Well, first of all, like platforms should allow discussions around sex and sexuality, like full stop.
Yes.
But also there's this idea that you can't talk about lingerie without also talking about sex. And that bothers me because not just because lingerie is a legitimate area of the fashion industry that I think deserves just as much consideration and exploration and expertise as the rest of the fashion industry. But there are also some really necessary conversations that come from the space around, you know, sexuality and gender identity and, you know, kind of your body presentation and all these other things that when we kind of lump lingerie directly in with sex, we don't necessarily have the space to have conversations specifically about intimate apparel in and of itself. And so that's one of the things I also try to do with my site. Is to get people to think of lingerie, to get people to think of intimate apparel as an interesting subject all on its own.
Yeah.
And as a diverse and nuanced topic all on its own without having to kind of bring other things into it.
Yeah, I think that is so true. Just in terms of, you know, who's making the rules over at these big tech giants, like what kind of filters are they putting into place where this is being filtered out? And you kind of have to imagine, you know, what those conversations look like at some of these big, important corporations that essentially, I mean, I hate to say it, but run really everything that we do. I mean, and you see it all the time on Instagram. Like you can see a very thin body, a thin, you know, white cisgendered body wearing next to nothing and no one says boo. And then you get a fat body or you get a gender nonconforming body or you get a black body and it is a whole other story. And then all of a sudden people's accounts are getting removed and people, and it's like, it just, we lose so much of the fun conversation that could be had, you know, about intimate apparel.
And it's so obvious.
Yes, it's so obvious. It's so obvious. I mean, like, they don't even try anymore to be like, oh, wow, it must have, you know, like, it's crazy that this happened. It's like, no, they actually put that in place. Like, that is actually supposed to happen, according to them. And you see it over and over again. And so much, I mean, I feel like, we've been watching that happen since 2015, since 2016, and it's still happening. And so it must take a lot away from you because you want to be able to focus on having this, you know, inclusive conversation about intimate apparel and about, you know, size inclusivity and gender and just getting to the fun of lingerie. But it ends up having to become this whole thing where it's like, can we even just get this into people's faces to begin with?
Yeah, exactly. Can we even talk to people? Can we even reach people? I mean, right. You could just look at Tumblr, where Tumblr essentially stripped. Oh my God. So just as an aside, before we start talking about that, I keep thinking about how Tumblr could absolutely be cleaning up right now. If only they just kept doing what they were doing like a few years ago, because everybody wants, what is it called? A chronological timeline. People want little short form blogs. Like, this could have been their moment to shine. Yes. And then they mess it up.
Now, so anyway, tell everyone what happened with Tumblr, just in case they don't know.
So Tumblr decided to ban all adult content of any kind. So that included content related to sex work, but also content related and sex work and pornography, but also content related to things like sexuality. So like LGBTQ plus identities. It shadow banned content related to lingerie and intimate apparel, like my own content. And not just that, the filters were set so broadly that even things like puppy dog pictures and kitty pictures were being dragged into the filter as being adult content. And my own site, I had like 90,000 followers, I think. And my Tumblr was going really well. It was sending a lot of traffic to my blog, you know, like we just talked about. And I was one of the accounts that got kind of caught into that adult filter. And I would look at my mentions and suddenly the only blogs. So for one thing, I wasn't getting any more like reblogs or anything. But the only sites that were able to see my site, the only times they were able to see mine were ones that were like really gross porn spam Tumblrs.
Yep.
And it was just like, so you decided to blacklist all these content creators, but you made this room for spammers. And like, what do you, like, you didn't do the thing you thought you were doing.
Oh,
people aren't gonna, I mean, that's the whole thing about social media, right? You need a critical mass of people to maintain it. And once people start leaving, once your site starts hemorrhaging, then it's just a, I guess, like a countdown until it's completely downhill.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think this.
I don't know if I'm making sense.
No, you are making sense. It's a great point. I mean, look, like, I think, I mean, my opinion is that I think censorship on many different levels on social media should be in place. All of these companies censor the wrong things. That's my opinion. I feel like the Nazis are running wild, but I can't see cute bras, and there's something wrong with that.
Well, it gets into the difference between what is the difference between having just a social platform, just essentially an online free for all,
right,
versus having a community?
Yes.
Because the essence of a community has to include community management. And these social platforms are not set up for community management. Community management is very difficult to scale. Like, it requires people and subtlety and rules and guidelines. So there's going to be some stuff you've got to ban.
It requires real humans that you have to pay.
It requires like boundaries.
Yes.
And these platforms, they are not in the business. Like, they say they're in the business of creating communities, but they're not actually in the business of creating communities. They're in the business of just acquiring users and getting people to use the site and to stay on the site.
Yes.
And truthfully, like, conflict, controversy, vulgarity, racism, homophobia, all of that attracts people. It gets them activity, which gets them ad dollars. And they're not really interested in creating or managing community. And
that's right.
When you know that is what's happening, then it's much easier to understand the decisions that platforms like Facebook and Tumblr and Twitter are making. They're not making it with community in mind.
That's right. And I this also reminds me of when I used to work in newsrooms, you know, publishing things that you knew I wouldn't make the decision, but being, and it wasn't necessarily, I will say, I would defend the places that I have worked, but you see a lot in media, like publishing stories that you know are going to get people riled up. And it's because on the back end, they don't care whether your click was a hate click or a not hate click. They just care that you click, and the clicking yields advertising dollars. And so it is difficult because, you know, yes, that's a business, but then you know what? Because community is hard to grow. Community
is
slow.
It's hard to maintain.
It's hard to maintain. It's expensive to maintain. You actually need real people. And people don't have time. People believe they don't have time to do that anymore. They want to just go. They just want to scale really, really fast. And so they burn really, really fast. And so, you know, that's the unfortunate part. But yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised that maintaining the Lingerie Addict on a social platform is a headache, because I can just imagine what is in place to keep you from getting the reach I think that you deserve.
Well, and also I very strictly moderate my community in terms of blog comments, in terms of Facebook comments. I have a group on Facebook that has about 5,000 members that we aggressively moderate. And it takes time and it takes effort. It takes time to create what I like to call like a safer space. I don't think there's any truly safe space online, but you can try to make safer spaces.
Yeah.
It would take a lot less time if we didn't do all that work, but then we wouldn't have the community we have.
That's right. Yeah. And then it's like, what's the point?
What's the point? Like, why are you, I don't understand. I feel like I'm just going off on tangents.
No, I love this. This is a great conversation to have. It's good.
I mean, how can you be a publication that talks about, you know, we're no place for hate. We don't believe in racism and homophobia and transphobia. But then people look in the comment section of your site or in the comments of your social media posts, and that's what they see. Like, it's not just enough to say these things. You have to actually follow through on the platforms that you control.
Right.
And a lot of sites and a lot of publications don't do that.
Yeah, and a lot of times those comments can sometimes, I mean, I'm a big, I don't know, I really, when I was writing, I really believe, like, you know, never read the comments because they all, you know, live in the basement. But it also is sort of a reflection of your community. If, like, the first thing that happens when you post something is, like, all this, like, hate, then it really makes you wonder, like, is this worth it? I'm not getting the kind of people I'm trying to reach anyway. But yeah, I mean, I really think that, like, all comments on, like, big media sites should be shut down. Like, I don't want to read, like, someone's comment on the news, like, that, you know, because then you get a lot of, like, QAnon stuff happening. But yeah, it's difficult. And also, like, just imagine that, you know, you were there in 2008 starting this. Like, this wasn't a thing. Like, there was just, it's all changed so much in the last 10 years.
It's completely different. Completely different place, a completely different environment. And even now we're seeing, like, some of those first bloggers kind of, you know, bowing out from the space, like Manrepeller just shut down.
That's right.
Because it's like, it's not enough to do what she was doing. Like, we don't see, I think, like, Garen Store, I haven't heard that name in a while. The Sartorialist was big when I started. I haven't heard that name in forever.
Wow.
I think Susie Bubble is still around, but I don't see her name as much as I used to. So, like, a lot of these first, Brian Boy is still around. I see his name all the time.
Yeah.
A lot of the first blogs have also just kind of fallen away or decided it's no longer worth their time.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, people do grow and evolve out of this stuff, and that makes sense. But I think people really had no idea in 2008, you know, what was even possible. And also just how often you would have to be pivoting because things change so much. Like, before we take a quick break, I was just remembering, I'm like a big Olympics person. I love watching the Olympics because I love, like, a personal story. And I remember watching London 2012, and it was the first Olympics where people were really on Twitter all the time. And the way that the Olympics really works is that they film everything wherever they're doing the Olympics, and then they air all of the big events in the prime time. And for the first time ever, you were getting updates on who won what way before they aired.
Yeah, in real time.
And NBC, like, did not know what to do. And it was like, no one even considered it. Like, no one, I remember finding out who won between, like, Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte and, like, the 100 meter or whatever at, like, 2 p.m., but you weren't really supposed to watch it until 8. And then it was a mess. It was a real mess. And they only had 4 more years to figure out how they were going to do it for Rio. And it's like, you can't even, I mean, that was only 8 years ago, and you had the biggest media conglomerate in, honestly, one of the biggest in the world saying, like, oh, we didn't think of this. Like, we didn't think of the fact that, it, you know, if the race is over at 2 p.m. in London, or at, you know, at 9 p.m. in London, and we're not showing it until 8 p.m. in the U.S., like, there are ways people are going to find out who won, and there are ways that people are going to be able to broadcast it. And we're going to step all over our prime time. It's just wild. It is a lot of pivoting. And yeah, you kind of have to be ready to, like, get into it for success.
We've seen a lot of these legacy brands struggle with, I think, staying up to date and relevant. I mean, in my industry, the big example is Victoria's Secret.
Right.
Industry behemoth, once controlled 2/3 of the American intimate apparel industry. Major player. Everybody knows the name. absolutely refuse to do any kind of pivoting whatsoever at all.
It's wild.
And we're seeing the consequences of it now. Like, you have these big companies that should have consultants and experts and, you know, people on their team giving them advice on what to do. But if the leadership is conservative and if the leadership isn't open to changing things, then you wind up with situations like what you described or situations like Victoria's Secret, mm-hmm. which, I mean, are just, it's reflective of who's in charge.
And that's what happens when old white men are running the show.
Basically.
It's really true. I mean, that, like, so much. I mean, Victoria's Secret is such a good example because I get it. Like, sometimes brands are like cruise ships. Like, it's harder to pivot them when they're that big. But, like, they should have been, they have a ton of money. They should have been able to see this coming. Like, there are people who get paid to forecast this kind of stuff. And the fact that they missed it entirely, or that they were just like, we don't want to believe
I think they just didn't want to do
it. They didn't want to do it. We're going to take a quick break and we will be right back. Okay, we're back. So I love this conversation because I love like kind of looking at the history of blogging. It also just seems like it's like the Industrial Revolution, but like jam packed into like, I don't know, in the timeline of creation, all of this stuff happened in seconds. and it's wild. And you've really been able to harness change as it comes and go with it. And I think that that's really amazing.
Well, it helps being in a niche. Like I have a very deliberate and specific niche that I stick to, which, I mean, some people think is kind of a downside because I can't talk about, you know, say like home decor, housewares or shoes or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the upside to that is that my site and what I do stays relevant for longer. And also the fact that my site is more informational as opposed to kind of like outfit of the day or daily wear kinds of things also helps because I get to bring in or get to have like a steady stream of traffic.
Yeah.
That's not dependent on trends or even on me and what I wear, which has always been the goal, I think, for my site. If it's just about me and what I'm doing, I don't think that's very interesting. Like, I don't have enough going on in my life to just run a site about me.
I got that.
Having content, though, that I think that educates people, that teaches people, and that answers people's questions, that's what people want to see. And particularly in the niche of lingerie right now, there is more interest than ever before in intimate apparel due to things like the Victoria's Secret conversation, due to things like the launch of Savage X Fenty. That has people like searching for lingerie, searching for information, wanting to know more. Mm-hmm. And so being in a position where I can offer that information to people, I think matters more than ever. And that, like we talked about Instagram a little bit ago, that's something you can't do on Instagram. Instagram is not searchable. Like you cannot search captions, which is for the best, truthfully.
Maybe.
But you cannot search captions on Instagram. The content isn't like, it doesn't resurface like after a couple of days, it's basically done and disappeared. And one of the major advantages to blogs is that content is always there. That content can always be referred to, even if blogs aren't cool or whatever. I don't know.
They have
a longevity that you're not going to get through social media.
That's right. I think to your point that it's like, you know, just to understanding that I do think a lot of bloggers, and some of them do it so well, and I think that that's fine. It's like memoir writing. It's like sometimes you want to read the story about the one person, but I think it's very smart to be like, what else am I going to say about me today? And also it's way more interesting to just open up that window and get a diverse amount of thought and style and shopping and preference. And I was just reading earlier today the post you put up yesterday from Neptune Violent. So Neptune wrote, "Discovering Myself, the Transcendent Queerness of Gender Fluid Lingerie." And I was reading it captivated because I believed that, you know, I knew trans and non-binary folks, you know, had places to get lingerie, and I never really thought about the very nitty-gritty and specifics of all of it. And she wrote about how when you ask, like a seamstress can tell you about the trends in gender and in lingerie, because mm-hmm. Lots of times, like, all of our lingerie is quite literally cut from the same cloth. You know, there's mm-hmm. measurements that people go by, and there's an understanding of, like, back width and, you know, cup size. And a lot of that doesn't work anymore because it's not 1950. But even just reimagining what that looks like for a trans person or a non-binary person, it was so interesting. And it's like, it took me 5 minutes to read and I walked away being like, huh, yeah, obviously. But like, where else mm-hmm. am I going to be able to read about that? And I think that there's something very niche about this, but it's also like, this is what mainstream intimate apparel, I think, misses. Mm-hmm. And what it desperately needs right now is like way more normalizing of whatever's happening not inside of a Victoria's Secret.
Right. Of the conversations people are having.
Yeah.
And kind of where, for me, the question is blah blah blah. The question is also, if people have these questions, like, where can they get answers? Where can they go and get reliable information? Where mm-hmm. can they go to a source they hopefully trust and get those answers? And I really try to position my site as a resource where, kind of, no matter what direction you're coming at intimate apparel from, no matter what your background is, you'll be able to find at least a little something for you.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I cover everything. Like, I am a person, like, just one person running the site.
Yes. Yes. I can't believe it, but yes, it's true.
Like, it's just me. Sometimes people are like, well, you haven't done this and you haven't. I'm like, it's literally just me. Like, I have to, like, sleep and eat and stuff. Like,
that's
I'm
right.
I try my best.
Don't have to explain it to me. I get it. It's hard. I think people are forgiving of that, right? I mean, I feel like you've done an amazing job.
I think a lot of people, I think, one, they have the perception there are more people on my site than me.
Yeah.
But I also think a lot of people just don't understand, like, the work it takes to keep a site up and running regularly.
Yeah.
To edit things, to update things, to post things. And then to also, in my case, handle everything else. Like, I handle the advertising, I handle PR, I handle interview requests.
That's right. Yes. Right.
So kind of like everything related to my site, I do. The social media,
mm-hmm.
Like, the emails, if you see me responding to a comment on Twitter, like, that's actually me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot to handle. And I enjoy it, and I enjoy what I do. But I also think that for some people, they don't, I mean, and it's not their fault. Like, most people don't make a living, like, writing or running websites or whatever.
Yes.
I think some people just kind of don't understand the work that's involved. But back to my previous point, I try to make TLA, the Laundry Addict, a place where as many people as possible can hopefully find something relevant to them.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a wonderful site. I'm now looking at that rainbow tulle robe and I'm like, do I need this? And I feel like the answer is yes. I will link it in the show notes so you guys can all see, but it's like amazing. I'm like seriously staring at it being like, I'm trying to imagine myself walking around my house in it, and I feel like I can do it. Yeah, you know what's funny? No, everyone thinks internet falls from the sky. Like, mm-hmm. like, I feel like I worked at BuzzFeed for a while, and I feel like a big joke that people would do if, you know, that wasn't their job was like, oh, like, your job is to write. I mean, my job wasn't this, but I feel like people thought of BuzzFeed and it's like, wow, hard job. You just, like, collect cat pictures and, like, you know, write quizzes. And I'm like, I get it. You know, it's not brain surgery. It's not rocket scientists, but, like, it is work. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's weird work, but, like, that stuff on the internet, like, exists because someone put it there. Someone just had to put it together. Like, that's work. I'm not defending the difficulty of finding cat pictures, but I think people do think it just sort of, like, arrives on the site and no one had to do anything.
I think this is part of a larger conversation around hidden labor and kind of the devaluation of labor, or at least the devaluation. I don't know why my tongue is struggling right now.
It's 2020, Cora. That's why. We don't know how to talk anymore. We don't know how to do any. Like, we're broken. We are broken.
This is the longest conversation I've had with someone, like, not my
husband. Me too. I get it. I really get it. Sorry, you were saying the devaluation of.
Right. Well, I think that's also a part of a conversation about the devaluation of labor, or about the devaluation of certain kinds of labor, because we have those same conversations in intimate apparel, where people are like, well, a bra shouldn't cost that much, it's just a little bit of fabric. I'm like, actually,
oh my God.
What you're paying for is the labor
yes.
it takes to put those little bits of fabric together. because like we can't just automate a machine to do it. Someone is literally at a sewing machine taking those 30 scraps of fabric and underwire and closures and elastic and putting them into a three-dimensional like structure that can lift and support your breasts. And that takes like expert level sewing. You can't just sit in front of a sewing machine on your first day and put together a bra.
Now,
that labor is invisible to people. They don't see it, and therefore they don't understand it or appreciate it.
I realize that that is the question that I wanted to ask you, because I didn't know this until maybe a year ago, and then I never actually confirmed it. I didn't realize machines cannot make bras and underwear. Is that true?
Right. So we don't have any machines that can automatically make any of our clothing. Like, I focus on intimate apparel because that's my area, but it includes like t-shirts and jeans. Like, there are people who sat there and sewed all that together. We don't have robots making our clothing.
But even like a machine, like, I mean, maybe
they use sewing machines. Is that what you're asking?
Well, I mean, like, I know they use sewing machines and stuff, but I guess sometimes I think of mass produced things.
Yeah, they're an assembly line, but there are still people there sewing. So it might just be like one person is sewing, like maybe one person is just sewing underwire channels and one person is just sewing eye closures, and one person is just doing like the seamed cup.
Yeah.
But those are still, that's just like an assembly line style of production. It's still people doing that sewing.
Yep. And there's that labor that we don't think or talk about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean,
primarily because it's outsourced to women of color. Like, there's also a gender and a racialized component here. I mean, there are very few conversations talking about or devaluing the labor of coal miners. Even as we move away from being dependent upon coal as an energy resource, like the labor of coal miners, this isn't like a diss on coal miners, but the labor of coal miners is still seen as valuable and worth preserving and worth saving. But the labor of seamstresses is not.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that feels very obvious now that you said it.
Right, and then we look at who's doing each occupation.
Right.
And that the hierarchy becomes more clear.
Yes, absolutely. And I think a lot of us, myself included, know this from like a tangential standpoint, but I think to have that conversation obviously changes, you know, the way that I would now look at my bras and my clothing. And just sort of the way that might change how I consume.
I tell people, no matter whether you bought your underwear in like a $5 for $20 bin at Target, or you bought it, you know, for $200 from Age Provocateur, like, somebody set at a sewing machine and put it together. Mm. Like, it was all made by a person.
Yeah.
And I hope that helps people to understand what they're saying. Because again, like, generations ago, people grew up sewing their own clothes, knowing people who sew, going to a tailor. These were a part of our collective cultural consciousness. And then sewing jobs and kind of mass sewing were outsourced primarily overseas. And so we just don't grow. Most people don't grow up using sewing machines or even being around a sewing machine. People are not growing up making their own clothes, tailoring their own clothes. People just don't know what they're looking at. It's like a foreign language almost, until someone sits there and basically explains the thing that they're seeing. Like, I say that I'm like teaching people how to read a bra.
I love that.
Every seam, everything means something. And there was part of understanding that story or that narrative is also remembering that there was a person, or more likely several people, behind getting it to you.
Yeah. I mean, that makes a ton of sense. I think I don't know how to use a sewing machine. And I think if I were to learn and if I were to make like one thing, I think it would change the way I look at every single thing that I wear.
Every home sewer I know who's ever made a bra or attempted a bra, and these are people who like sew, they know how complicated it is to make dresses and things. Like, they all are like, bras are difficult. We should actually be paying much, much more for bras than we do. Anyone who makes a bra will tell you that. The fact that, and this is a controversial opinion when discussing fashion, like, the fact that we can afford bras at all in any capacity is a sign or a signal or part of how we know we're undervaluing that labor. Because when you look at the cost of ethically made lingerie, It tends to be priced higher, and there is a reason for that. Not always, just kind of talking about like a general trend.
Mm-hmm.
When something is made in America, for example, it's going to be priced like probably 20 to 30% higher than it would be if it was made in, I don't know, like Bangladesh or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, how am I trying to put this? What people often think of as overpriced when it comes to certain brands.
Yes.
Can be reflective instead of labor costs and other costs. Like, yes. there's other stuff that goes into, like, you know, the cost of laundry includes things like shipping and taxes and duties and mm-hmm. customs, and material does have some effect in the final cost. Like, if you've purchased a lace that costs like $500 a meter,
mm-hmm.
like, you're not going to get a $30 lingerie set out of that.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly.
Can influence, but even in that case, the labor still matters so much more, because you have to be so experienced if you're going to put together a $500 meter lace
right.
into a bra.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a ton of sense that just, you know, the give and the take, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch, you know, the onset, the advent of the $5 t-shirt and fast fashion, mm-hmm. you know, meant something positive for the accessibility of mm-hmm. fashion, for body sizes, for socioeconomic class differences. But then it gets us prepared to say, oh, like $60 for a bra, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. When it's not crazy, it's actually probably way less expensive than it should yeah. be. But we are so right. used to a $9.99 bra from the Gap.
Yeah.
And
right.
and it's, again, like, you know, we talk about it a lot here. I hate blaming the consumer because there are other people to blame first. But it does give you a lot of perspective when you're looking at stuff, you know, like, it all of this stuff determines a price. And mm-hmm. and
well, yeah. I think we can have a conversation that, because often when you talk about the price of things, people get very offended, like, well, I can't help it, I can't afford this, and you're right, price right, right. shaming me. And I'm like, no, talking about how things are made is not price shaming you. Like, asserting that everyone deserves a fair and living wage, including the people who make our clothes,
yes.
is not price shaming you. Like, if you say that you deserve to be paid a fair wage, then so does everyone else. Like, it's not just you.
We are closer. We are closer to the wage of a seamstress than we are to, you know, what Mark Zuckerberg makes. You know, like, right. I think the people who they try to pit against each other to fight this out, which is, you know, people who are against, you know, a fast fashion or against a $5 t-shirt, and then the people who are like, well, all I can afford is a $5 t-shirt, we're actually all on the same side.
Right. The issue is not that things cost too much, is that you're not being paid enough.
Right.
Like, those aren't the same thing. And people often think the issue is things are overpriced, when no, the issue is that your wages are suppressed, and therefore things you should be able to afford if you were being paid fairly for your labor are out of reach.
Yes. Yeah. I think that is correct.
But also I think we can also have kind of simultaneous conversations about how people can only afford so much, and a lot of things are therefore out of their reach. Like, those shouldn't be, those are not oppositional conversations.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, we can discuss how you can't afford $1,000 coat or whatever. I don't know. But also that there are some coats that are worth $1,000. Like, these conversations should not be opposites. And I think one thing everyone can do to contribute to ethical consumption, ethical fashion, the awareness of ethical production and manufacturing, is to not diminish the labor of the people who make our clothes. Like, everyone, no matter what you can afford, no matter what you make, no matter what you buy, we can make sure that we're not contributing to the conversation of asserting that the people who make our clothes do not deserve to be paid fairly.
We are going to take another quick break, and when we come back, Cora is going to tell us what she brought to G Thanks Just Bought It.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Okay, we're back. Cora, I need to know, what did you bring?
I brought a ripped bodice. Oh, what is it called? It's not a gift pack, a surprise pack. There's a name for these.
Okay.
Grab bag, I think. I think it's a grab bag.
Cool.
I'm like surprise package.
Yeah, right.
Care package.
Surprise box.
Care package.
Got it.
It's like surprise package? Care box? Care package. Ripped bodice care package.
There we go.
So when things shut down, obviously a lot of businesses shut down, including bookstores. I was supposed to do a book signing at Ripped Bodice earlier this year. Mm. And that got canceled because everything shut down.
Yeah.
And one of the things Ripped Bodice started doing to bring some more money back in, bring some revenue back in, was offer book care packages where you would fill out like a Google survey, mm-hmm. A Google form, and send them an amount of money for like 3 books, 5 books, whatever, however many books. And they would choose books for you and like ship them to you. You wouldn't know what they were choosing. You didn't really have any say in what they were choosing. They would send things they thought you would like.
Oh, I love that.
I don't know if it was a 3 or 5 book care package. Anyway, those are my very first romance novels. And now I am addicted to romance novels. They are the best. I don't know how I avoided this genre for so long. And the Ripped Bodice care package is what got me started on my romance kick. And that has been one of the best things I have done since this whole coronavirus pandemic started, because the world is distressing and things are terrible.
Yeah.
But every romance novel has a happy ending. And it's great.
And okay, so I am such a big fan of like a delicious beach read. Like I love candy for reading. You know, I just like I love a well-written book that is not trying to make me cry, that is going to end well. So, but I've never really dealt. I mean, I've read like a couple of the romance books that have made their way into mainstream book world, but I've never really gone deep on a romance book. Like how did you decide that you wanted to take the plunge and just like get into the genre?
Well, I started with Ripped Bodice because I wanted to support them. I wanted to support an indie bookstore. Mm-hmm. I wanted to support a bookstore that offered to host me for a book signing. So that was how I started. It wasn't a lot of money to send. I wanted some reading material. I wanted to support them. So for me, it was a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out I actually like really, really like romance.
So what was the first book that you read?
You know, I don't remember the name of it. Uh-huh. I would have to go and find it on my bookshelf.
Okay.
Hang on. Well, I mean, I could go look now, but what was the... It was a lesbian romance set in like the early 20th or late 19th century.
Wow.
Gosh, now I don't remember the name of it.
You'll find it and we can link to
it. I will find it.
But were you just like so hooked after that?
Yeah, I was. Like I said, it was just happy. It was an escape. It was fun. And I feel like we need escapes now. We need things that uplift us, no matter what they are. Like for me, it turns out that was romance novels. Mm-hmm. But no matter where you can find joy, I mean, I think that's what we need.
Yeah, I agree. Especially, I know you'll be listening to this episode after the election, but we are recording this the week before the election. I imagine I will need as many books as I can get, depending on how this next week goes. Romance is, I would love to just dive in. I'm like looking now.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I'm looking at all of the books. First of all the books are so beautiful. All the fonts are cute. Like, I'm sorry that I'm judging a book by its cover, but I definitely am. Everything looks great.
No, for romance, especially, everybody does.
Right? Do you feel like it's evolved from, you know, what I think of when I think of romance books is like, you know, the Samson blonde hair man with the chiseled chest in the grocery store and a princess with big boobs on the cover, you know, I like, has that, evolved since the late 80s? Like, do you feel like...
Well, I mean, I wasn't keeping up with romance in the late 80s or the 90s. I'm very, very new to the genre. But I can say from the books that I am reading, those are not the covers that I'm seeing.
That's awesome. That is
However,
cool.
to be fair, I think vintage romance covers from the 80s and 90s are awesome in their own right because they are so dramatic and so over the top. And so full of like angst and torture.
Yes.
That just like the covers themselves as a genre
right.
are entertaining as hell.
And who knew there were so many different ways to say penis?
It's fantastic.
No, that's amazing. This reminds me of when I got really into cozy mysteries a few years ago. Are you a cozy mysteries person?
I am not. One of my best friends is, though. She loves a good murder mystery, and if it's on a train, even better.
Yes, perfect. Yeah, this there's like a baking cozy mystery. Like the Barnes & Noble near where I used to live in Brooklyn had like a whole shelf, and then Books Are Magic had a bunch of these. And I have been looking at ways to order them that are – they're all on Amazon, but I don't buy my books on Amazon, so I've just been trying to figure out who stocks them. But it's like – Strawberries and Strangers, or it's like A Cake to Die For, and the covers are all like just cake and being in the kitchen. This one's Magic and Macaroon.
I found the book title.
Oh, tell me.
The Lady's Guide to Celestial Mechanics.
Okay, that sounds amazing. I'm Googling it right now because I know that Ripped Bodice is in LA, and I'm actually looking up their hours right now, and I'm like, do I have time to get there by the end of the day?
So that was my introduction to the genre.
Okay.
And both of my best friends who are also in New York, at them, Gina Cadlick and my friend who runs another lingerie blog, Sweet Nothings.
Mm-hmm.
We all three of us got that book in our care packages, and we all loved it. It's so good. And that was my fast track into the romance world.
I am so in. Like, I'm looking right now and I'm like, once we get off the phone, like once we are done with this episode, I'm getting in the car and going to the Ripped Bodice and I'm going to buy this book. I will also say, you guys, that on Goodreads, this book has a rating of 4.1 out of 5, which is, if you've ever spent any time on Goodreads, that is incredible. No one on Goodreads likes any book.
If somebody is like, this is the worst book I ever read, like that'll sting just a little bit. Like, then I would be like, okay, well, you know, maybe it is the worst book they ever read. I don't know what else they read.
Right. Right. I don't know your life. Like, I don't know. I don't know what you're reading. I think, I think I don't care. My book did well no matter what. I just think Goodreads readers are critical, and I will allow that. It's just none of my business. But
once it's out there, you can't do anything. Like once it's out there, like there's just nothing to
do. There's
be
nothing
done.
You can do. And you
the
have
way
to
people receive it isn't up to you. Like I've only written one book, but like I put out the best book I could at the time. I know it was the best book I could put out. And how people receive my best work isn't...
That's not your problem. Nothing to do with that. The thing that I've had to do is communicate to my mom, like, stop reading the you know, the one or two Amazon reviews or the one or two Goodreads reviews that are like, I didn't get this book, I didn't like it, and then stop calling me and telling me about it. Like, I don't want to know. My mom's like, do you want me to respond to them? I'm like, no, I don't want you to respond.
No,
I appreciate
never,
it. We don't feed the haters respond. Here in this house. We do never. Not feed the haters. But people seem to love The Lady's Guide to Celestial Mechanics. Beautiful cover, two beautiful women, a clear queer book. As Lucy Michelini watches her ex-lover's sham of a wedding, she wishes herself anywhere else. It isn't until she finds a letter from the Countess of Moth looking for someone to translate a groundbreaking French astronomy text that she knows where to go. Oh my gosh. Then she meets a woman of her dreams. Oh, I can't wait.
It's so good.
I can't wait.
It's so good.
So how long did it take you to read this? Like, did you immediately just go on to the next book in the bundle?
Yeah. This is the one I liked most of all. And when somebody is like, recommend a romance novel to me, like that's a good starter romance novel. Like it is this one.
Fantastic. Well, I'm definitely in. I need books for the winter. I'm trying hard to get some escapism into my life. I feel like I've been rewatching like The Real Housewives of New York and like, you know, just fun. I love to watch women scream at each other. I find that very calming. And but on the third episode of like the second season from 2007, one of them mentions Donald Trump, and I'm like, I can't get away from this. Like, stop. No, I need Amazon or Google to improve their like Alexas or their Google Home so that like I can mute words from coming out of my TV. And then that's where I would start. So I feel like as long as there's no Donald Trump mentions in any of these romance books, which I can't imagine that there are, I will be so happy. This is such a good recommendation.
Oh good. I hope you like it. Like if you get it and you're like, this is the worst book I ever
read. I'm gonna leave a bad Goodreads review on your book. And I'm gonna be like, her book's good, but she has a horrible recommendation. No, I can't wait. This is a whole genre I haven't even touched. You know?
I hadn't either. Like not I wasn't deliberately avoiding it. I never thought to read it. And so the thing about, you probably know this because you've written books, is that like the romance novel industry basically supports everything else.
Yes.
Because people will just binge romance, as I have done these last 6 months. People will just binge romance.
Yes.
And so I understand. I didn't understand why, even though I'd heard that, I didn't understand why it was. And now that I am a dedicated romance fan, I completely get it. I understand the appeal of the genre so much better now.
There is something to be said about, you know, I hate the term guilty pleasure in terms of books, really in terms of anything. I think you should enjoy. Enjoy what you want to enjoy. And I don't love that everyone's like, oh, my guilty pleasure is like chick lit. It's like books. No. Just read books. But you
just
know
read
what?
Your book.
Like everyone loves to laud these very serious, very literary books. But that's not what people buy in droves. Like people buy romance novels, people buy mystery novels in droves. Like those mass market paperbacks, you're right, they keep the genre going and there's nothing crazy about it. I think I remember when 50 Shades of Grey came out, which by the way, my dad who's a journalist, like had heard about 50 Shades of Grey before really knowing what it was, but he knew it was like he knew it was trendy and he knew everyone was reading it, so he was like, you should read this. And I was like, okay, do you know what it's about, Dad? And then it got awkward pretty fast. But when 50 Shades of Grey came out, you know, Kindle sales went up like 100% because everyone was so embarrassed to be reading it. And so they wanted a Kindle so no one could tell what they were reading. And I just thought that was so interesting that and it's always, you know, it's always women. Like we put so much shame on what you should be reading and what you shouldn't be reading and what you should be, like just read and read what you want and who cares. I read so much YA. Like I love YA. I'm 33. I love a good teen novel. I don't care. Like I don't think anyone
The genre is so much. There wasn't really a YA genre when I was in that age category.
Same.
I mean, it's awesome that there's so many books to choose from and that they all have like such good plots, or so many of them have such good plots, I should say.
There are, there's so many good ones. I feel like they all get, I don't know, they're just good. And I feel like romance, I just have not, I'm in now. Cora, you've like hooked me.
You're there.
Well, I'm literally like, I'm going to the Ripped Bodice like in 20 minutes. Yeah.
Yes. Good. The other thing, my husband and I were talking about this. We talked about this a few times. So many people don't like reading, and so many people read at a grade level that I think it's like around eighth grade. Mm-hmm. And they go to school and they grew up and they're like, I hate reading. Reading's the worst. Reading's terrible. And when you look at what we're required to read, it makes so much sense. Like what would be, if we want people to love reading, why not give them things that are easy to read and fun to read? Like give kids graphic novels, give kids young adult fiction, give kids romance novels. Like I don't care.
Read.
If we want to actually cultivate people who love reading. And you're not going to do that with fucking War and Peace or whatever.
No, you're not. Unless you're one of those weirdos who loves reading War and Peace or like, you know, the Robert.
No offense to the War.
Yeah, no, lovers, yeah, no, no offense to the weirdos.
I don't think any high schooler is like raring to go on
and
that.
I got to give a shout out to my friend Danielle Mullen. She is the only black woman owned bookstore owner in Chicago. She owns Semicolon. She's amazing. She came on the show back in June and she and I keep in touch. And she and I had this kind of conversation where it's like school gives you some of the most boring books in the world. And so our our introduction to reading is this slog of like, I have to read it. I have to do it. And so she has really made an art form out of taking, what did she tell me she did? It was really amazing. She takes the school, you know, curriculum for Chicago Public Schools, and she'll find a novel, mostly usually written by a Black author or an author of color about Black people or people of color, that follows those same things. And so she'll say, she said, Coldest Winter Ever by Sister Soldier was like The Great Gatsby. So it's like, if you have to read The Great Gatsby for school and you're not into it, like, how about try this book? It will feel, you will recognize the people, you will recognize the places, the language, the way people talk to each other, you know, what they're wearing. And it's not going, it's not about stuffy white people from 1921. And she says over and over again, kids come back and they're like, I get it. And I want to read more. And it's like, that's what we have to do for all kids everywhere, because those books are boring. I didn't like To Kill a Mockingbird. I think I faked read it. I don't think I actually read it. I think I read the Cliff's Notes.
I would read those books and be like, well, what does this?
Yeah.
What does this have to do? Like, why aren't we having kids read, like, for, in terms of, I love comics. So like for graphic novels, why aren't we having kids read Mouse? I don't know how to pronounce it.
Of course.
Like for the Holocaust, why don't we have kids reading like Persepolis to learn about Iran? Like, why don't we have kids reading Saga as a novel? Like, it's such a good series. Like, why don't we, why don't we have kids reading like Why the Last Man in a feminist class? Like, there are so many other ways to talk about and access these ideas that would frankly be a lot more exciting and interesting and relatable than, you know, reading Flannery O'Connor or something. I do not like Flannery O'Connor. I had to read her in my English class.
you left a bad Goodreads review on Flannery O'Connor. Yeah, no, I mean, look at Hamilton and the interest in American history, you know, after that. Like, if you make things enjoyable and you can really connect with the audience, then you're going to have, then people are actually going to learn, you know, when it feels like homework, because it is homework, I'm already tapped out. And I do feel like a lot of my early adulthood, my early 20s, was sort of relearning how to love reading again after school was over. Because there was so much stuff that I was like, I love to read, but this feels like a chore to me. And it's taking, and then after I'm done reading this thing I don't want to read, the last thing I want to do is read anything else. And I lost it there for a little bit. But now, I actually deactivated Twitter a few weeks ago, about 10 years too late. I should have just never joined to begin with. But now I have all this free time where I'm not like reading stuff that makes me sad. So I feel like maybe romance novels, that's going to be my next stop.
Oh, good. Welcome. World. I feel like I have been heartily embraced by other romance aficionados.
Nice.
I maybe don't go in as deep as I have, because I have been racking up some dollars reading romance.
I'm happy. I'll give the Rip Bodice all of my money. I'm literally like, I'm waiting for my husband to come home with the car, and then I'm going to take the keys and be like, I'm out. I'll see you later. And I'm going to come back with a lot of books. I am so excited. Cora, thank you so much for coming to Gee Thanks Just Bought It.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me. I hope, like, I haven't done a lot of, I don't talk to a lot of people, kind of.
You did amazing.
I hope you got what you wanted.
Yes. Oh my God, are you kidding? This was the most fun conversation. I love that you're like, I don't talk to a lot of people. It's like, none of us talk to a lot of people, Cora. We're all inside our house. Like, I haven't seen another human in quite some time. You guys, please go visit The Lingerie Addict. It is amazing. It is so inviting and approachable. And I'm going to link to that rainbow tulle robe. And no one can buy it, because I'm going to buy it. So just make, you can buy it after I buy it. Just leave one for me. I am so excited for y'all to hear this episode. Cora, this was wonderful. I hope you come back again, and we will keep in touch. I will tell you all about the romance books that I am reading.
Well, thank you again for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Everyone, you can follow Gee Thanks Just Bought It at Gee Thanks Just Bought It Pod on Instagram, and we will see you next Friday for another episode.